At some point in our lives, we're inclined, almost compelled sometimes, to shake our fist in the emptiness of the sky and just scream, unfair. Especially as we hear and see things that seem as though God is unattentive or uncaring to what we're going through. And for some, the feeling of unfairness, it's aroused simply by having to wait too long on the traffic light, trying to find a parking space when you're late, or even taking too long in a Starbucks coffee line. But daily, so many people cry out in pain, just being overwhelmed with that sense of unfairness because they struggle with a wayward spouse or a child, because they've got cells that have, for some crazy reason, have become cancerous, or maybe organs that have failed to function as designed. The alcoholic, the homosexual, the gambler, the rebel, they face the inner struggles with sin that has been with them. Can they rightly accuse God of making them that way? As we face the loss of a job, or maybe in this case, the loss of a meeting place, we ponder whether God is really in control. And if He is, does He really have a clue what we're going through? Does He really have a clue? So let me ask you, was Hitler raised up strictly to bring attention to the plight of the Jew and set a stage for the resurrection of the Israeli nation? Were two young men in Columbine, Colorado, raised up simply to bring the detail of what our children are going through in our schools? Did 3,000 people die on September 11th so that the world could enter into a war that would bring about the Antichrist? We don't know that one yet. If so, can any of these be blamed for their actions? Can any of them be blamed for their actions? Can any of these rightly, fairly, justly be punished for carrying out the will of God? Over the next 2 weeks, we're going to be looking at the first 9 of the 10 plagues that God has put upon Egypt. Today, we're going to explore the mind of God and the way He reveals Himself through these plagues. And next week, we're going to explore the heart of God. And we're going to attempt to answer those very natural questions that come out when we look at Scripture honestly. And ask, why, God? Why did you do this? Was this really necessary? Last week, Moses went before Pharaoh and demanded that Israel be allowed 3 days' journey to worship the Lord, specifically Yahweh. And Pharaoh replied with an extremely important statement that's going to come back to haunt him as we look through Scripture today. Who is Yahweh that I should obey His voice to let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, nor will I let Israel go. So Moses gets tossed on his ear. The children of Israel are given more work in response, because Pharaoh's response was, if you've got that much time to sit around and think about going out and worshiping some god, you don't have enough to do. So he took away the straw that they were using to make bricks, but he didn't reduce the quota. So now all of a sudden they have to go not only go make the bricks, but they have to find the straw to make the bricks. So, of course, the children of Israel came back and complained to Moses. And Moses did the right thing. He went back to God and he said, what are we doing here? What exactly did you promise? So God has reassured Moses. And he tells him, you're going to make a request? Pharaoh's going to deny you that request. You're going to make a demand? Pharaoh's going to deny you that demand. I get the whole situation under control. So Moses, to his credit, I mean, after just a total defeat, Moses, to his credit, goes back into the presence of Pharaoh. And that's where we pick up the story. So if you would, turn with me to Exodus chapter 7. And the title of this message is The Mind of God. So the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt, but Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, When I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring about the children of Israel from among them, then Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded them, so they did. And Moses was 80 years old, Aaron 83 years old, when they spoke to Pharaoh. God tells Moses that you're going to be as a god to Pharaoh, and that is going to come true as we see as we the progression of these plagues, that Pharaoh is going to continue to look to Moses as the interceder, almost the guy that's in control. Now, one of the things that we need to get to immediately as we go through this, and by the way, we're not going to read all nine plagues. We're going to go through the nine of the first, for the first nine of the ten, and we're not going to read word for word. That's three chapters. I think that would be pretty boring in a public setting to read three chapters. So what I'm going to be doing is summarizing the chapters for you, if you would. But one of the things that we first need to get to, and if you're taking notes, I would really encourage you to note this, where it says, harden Pharaoh's heart. We're going to see that phrase so much that it's important to define it up front. There are three words that are used, three Hebrew words that are used when it says harden. And we have to determine which one of those words is being used at the time. The first one is kabad, K-A-B-A-D, and it means to give weight to or to honor. Interestingly enough, that same word is used when it talks about the honor or the glory of God. But basically what it means is to honor something. It also could mean to hold one's own counsel, giving honor to one's own heart. In Proverbs 21:2, it says, every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the hearts. The second one we're going to see is kasha, which means to make stiff, to stiffen. And the third one is kazak, which is to hold or to prevail or to make resolute. In Proverbs 21:1, this is the idea of this. In Proverbs 21:1, it says, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord like the rivers of water. He turns it wherever he wishes. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. That's basically what that word implies. So as we go through the plagues, it's going to be important to know which word is being used when. Now here, in this first one, the word kasha is used for the first and the last time, and that means to stiffen. And if you think, if it helps you, if you think about it in terms of clay, whenever you fire clay, it doesn't change the material because it's still clay. But it changes the composition. It hardens it. Pharaoh's heart was what it was. And God simply stiffened the material. Now, the request has been made. Pharaoh has stated, who is Yahweh and why should I obey him? And he refused to hold, to know the knowledge of God in his mind. So just like in Romans 1, God has begun to give him over to his own heart and to his own reasoning. And it says that God's going to multiply his signs and wonders through the plagues. Both of those words, by the way, signs and wonders, both can be translated miracles. Even though the Hebrew word for wonders is mofaith, as in it's going to take mofaith not to believe in God after this. It's in there. But in verse 5, it says, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, which I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. What he's basically saying is that these judgments against Egypt and against Pharaoh have a twofold purpose. And the first one is to judge against the Egyptians and their gods. And it's going to be fascinating as we see these plagues, how they judge the gods of Egypt. It's really fascinating. It may have taken up to a year for these plagues to play out. And during that time, Pharaoh's stock, if you will, is going down. Moses' stock is going up. But it may have taken as much as a year for all of those plagues to play out. And it says that the judgment is against the gods of Egypt and the gods and the people of Egypt to give proof to both Israel and to Egypt to know that the Lord is God. And if you break up those nine plagues, those first nine plagues, into sets of three, is a fascinating pattern. I have no idea what it means, but it's a fascinating pattern. The first two of each set is preceded by a warning and an opportunity for repentance. The third one of each set, of each of those sets of three, comes without warning. Proverbs 29:1 says, "He who is often rebuked and hardens," that same word, kasha, "he who is often rebuked and hardens his neck will suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy." So God says, He's going to tell Moses each time, go in and tell Pharaoh, this is what I'm going to do. One, two. The third one, just do it. Number four, go in and tell Moses what I'm going to do. Number five, go in and tell Moses what I'm going to do. Number six, just do it. Seven, eight, nine, same pattern. The second purpose is to bring out the children of Israel from bondage. So it's to judge against the Egyptians and their gods and to bring out the children of Israel from bondage. Now, in verses 8 through 13, it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, show a miracle for yourselves, then you shall say to Aaron, take your rod and cast it before Pharaoh and let it become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went in to Pharaoh, and they did so just as the Lord commanded. And Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. But Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, so the magicians of Egypt. They also did in like manner with their enchantments, for every man threw down his rod, and they became serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. And Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had said." And again, you just have to admire Moses walking right into Pharaoh's presence after being tossed on his ear, being rebuked by the children of Israel. And he's reassured by God. He goes back to God and he says, "What exactly did you promise me? What exactly did you say?" And God tells him. And he says, "Okay, I got it." And he goes on. That just blesses my heart. Now, the first sign that he shows, not a plague, but the sign that he shows, is that he throws down his rod and it becomes a serpent. That word for serpent actually translates sea serpent, not asp, not snake. It is a very good possibility that that was not a snake, as we seem to think in our popular understanding, but also could have been a crocodile, which would have been a whole lot easier to understand. It would be easier for a crocodile to consume two other crocodiles than it would be a snake. It would be a little difficult. But, so that's something to keep in mind. And that was a direct affront to the Egyptian god Sebek, who was a very, very evil god. As a matter of fact, he set himself against Ra, the sun god, and tried to prevent the sun from coming up each day with fog and mist and rain. He was a very evil god, and he had the head of a crocodile. That's how he was displayed. So this was a direct affront against the head of the crocodile. So Pharaoh calls in his magicians and his sorcerers, and they look at that and they go, "That's a croc," and they do the same thing. None of them are working. I'm sorry. But Pharaoh's heart grew hard. Here, the word that is used means that God prevailed. God was holding his heart in his hand. Now we go on to the first plague. What God tells Moses to do is to go to Pharaoh and to warn him. And he says, "If you do not let my people go by this time tomorrow, the Nile is going to be turned into blood. And by this you shall know that I am the Lord." So he turned the Nile River into blood. And this was an affront to the Egyptian god Num, who was said to be the guardian of the Nile. He showed he was basically unable to protect his territory. It was against the god Hapi, who was said to be the spirit of the Nile. And against the great god Osiris, who was one of the larger gods in Egypt, who was thought to have the Nile as his bloodstream. So their biggest god is now bleeding. And in fact, the Nile itself was worshipped as a god. And all of a sudden it's rendered not only useless, but dangerous. I mean, can you imagine blood flowing through the Ohio River? I mean, we don't fish there now for a good reason. Can you imagine what would happen if that happened? It would stink of blood. It would stink of fish. And not only that, your water source is now gone. Completely gone. Well, what God has done in this case is, again, He's judging the first of the Egyptian gods, or the first many of the Egyptian gods, in doing this. And He's basically saying, your gods cannot prevail against me. And in verse 22 of chapter 7, it says, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Again, that means that God prevailed or held his heart. And that passed after 7 days. The second plague, which is the frogs, was the goddess Heka, or it's also spelled H-E-Q-T, or Hekt. And that had a frog's head. It was a fertility god, and it had to do with rebirth. It's considered to be the mother of all gods. And Moses goes into Pharaoh and warns Pharaoh and tells him that this is going to occur if he doesn't let Israel go. So then, Pharaoh calls in the sorcerers, and they do the same thing. Excuse me, let me back up for a moment. With the Nile River, they also did the same thing. They turned the water into blood. So the question then becomes, well, where did they get the water? It says that they dug around the Nile and dug wells around there to get fresh water because the Nile was bloody. So the sorcerers would have gotten some of that water as well and been able to do the same thing. And that allowed Pharaoh to harden his heart because he could see that what God could do, his sorcerers could do. Same thing here. The frogs come in, he calls in his enchanters, and they can do exactly the same thing. Now let's think about that for a minute for frogs. You like frogs? You want frogs? You got frogs. Lots of frogs. Frogs in your bread, frogs in your bed, frogs in your hair. You can't walk without stepping on frogs. Ugh. I don't mind frogs, but that's enough. So, Pharaoh says, pray for me. Remove the problem, and I will honor God. You just remove the problem, and I will honor God. So, Moses said, okay, Pharaoh, you tell me when the frogs need to leave. And the reason why Moses gave Pharaoh the choice of when the frogs were to go was because Moses wanted to let Pharaoh know that this was no coincidence. That this wasn't just something that happened and is going to go away. He said, you appoint the time and they'll be gone. That should prove to you that God is who I say He is and then who He says He is. And so Pharaoh says, not get it out of here immediately. I mean, wouldn't you think that if you've got millions of frogs around that you would say, now would be a good time? He says, tomorrow. Tomorrow? Tomorrow. Get them out tomorrow. What's Pharaoh thinking? Pharaoh is thinking, this is still a coincidence. Maybe they'll go away by themselves. Maybe the problem will resolve itself. Or maybe, just maybe it won't resolve itself. Moses will be shown as a fraud. But he is. We still have frogs. You've got a fraud. So he was gambling that they would either go away by themselves or that they would not go away at all. But Moses knew that this was no coincidence. So, he said, you appoint the time, the frogs will be gone. He didn't say that they would leave, he said that they would be gone. So what did God do? Killed them. So now we have all these frogs that are hopping around are dead. And it says that they created quite a stench. So they had to gather up these little frog bodies and burn them. Nasty, nasty stuff. So when Pharaoh saw that the trouble had passed, it says that Pharaoh hardened his heart. What that means at that point is he honored his own heart. It says, as we read in Pharaoh's that the way of a man's eyes are right in his own the way of a man is right in his own eyes. That's basically what he's doing. He was holding his own counsel. The third plague, which was lice, this drove him absolutely nuts because Egyptians were, as a society, very, very clean. But the priests specifically, who were also hit with this lice, could not, because of their uncleanness, could not minister as priests. So basically what that did was effectively shut down all the temple worship because there were no priests. They had lice. They couldn't do it. So, but it's interesting to note that there was no warning. He simply said, strike the dust of the earth, and the lice is going to come up. He doesn't say, go tell Pharaoh. He just does it. So the sorcerers came in to work their enchantments, which basically translates their secret arts or their magic, and it didn't happen. So that begs the question, how could they work them before, and now they don't work? In 2 Thessalonians 27:12, it says, Second Thessalonians 2:7-12. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. And with all unrighteousness, deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, they might be saved. For this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Miracles are a part of Satan's arsenal. We will be deceived, or not us, because we're going to be gone, but those who remain on earth will be deceived by Satan's lying signs and wonders. He does have the capability of making miracles. And that's exactly what these guys were calling on. It was the power of the demonic that allowed them to do what they did. They finally met their match. And it says that these Egyptian magicians were intelligent. They were learned men, but they lacked the wisdom of God. As Paul observes concerning them in 2 Timothy 3, because there it says, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away. For of this sort are those who creep into households and make captive the gullible women, loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Now as Jannes and Jambres, the guys that we're talking about, the sorcerers, resisted Moses, so do those who also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds, disapproved concerning the faith, but they will progress no further, for their folly will be manifest to all, as theirs was also. Basically, he's saying that they're going to get to a point where they cannot do anymore what they were doing. They can only go so far. Think about it for a moment. The first two plus the crocodile were duplicated. Were duplicated. Now, if you were Pharaoh and you called in your magicians, and the guy throws down a crocodile, you throw down a crocodile, that's okay. That's all right. But they turn my river into blood, and you come in and you go, well, we can turn water into blood. No. Turn it back into water. Why can't you turn it back into water? They make frogs come out of the water. Make them go back. What are you doing? You're bringing in more frogs? You're duplicating the same thing? Satan cannot reverse the work of God. Take hope in that. Satan cannot reverse the work of God, but he can duplicate it. He can make it look like God. But he cannot reverse it. Unfortunately, we are more than willing to use whatever we can to deceive ourselves, especially if God is convicting us of something. The enemy will bring anything he possibly can into our way, duplicating what he thinks God might do in this situation. that will draw us off instead of facing what God is telling us to do. Please keep that in mind. Interestingly enough, the magicians said, this is the finger of God. They're starting to get a clue. They didn't even say the hand of God. This is just the finger, Pharaoh. Just the finger. They're starting to get a clue. And it says in verse 19 of chapter 8 that Pharaoh hardened his heart. It says Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, just as the Lord had said. What's the word there? God prevailed over his heart. God is holding his heart in his hand. Fourth plague is flies. Actually, flies, those flies are not the common household flies that we're familiar with, but they were scarabs or beetles, which were sacred to the sun god Ra. And there are a lot of gold beetles that were found in the ruins of Egypt that testified to this being one of the elements of the sun god Ra. Again, Pharaoh was warned, but this time God has also said that he's going to set apart the land of Goshen, so he is now beginning to distinguish the land of Israel, the people of Israel and the people of Egypt. He's now saying this is not going to happen to Israel, but it's going to happen to Egypt. So they're absolutely swarmed with flies. And in verse 22, God says that he is going to do this to show Pharaoh that he is in the midst of the land. I'm here. I'm right here. I'm not distant. I'm not doing this telepathically. I'm not doing this by remote control. Pharaoh, I'm here in the midst of the land, and I will show you what I can do in the midst of the land. So the first three were pretty disgusting and inconvenient, but now the plagues turn disease-ridden and pestilent. Now we've got a huge problem. So Pharaoh starts to strike a compromise. Okay. Tell you what. You go sacrifice to your God. Your God has said he's in the land. You go sacrifice to God, but don't go anywhere. Just here in Egypt. Take some time off and go sacrifice. But what that does, though, especially if we remember that Egypt is a type of the world, we recognize that we are worshiping under the eye and under the control of the world still. We don't separate ourselves unto God. How often are we asked to do that, and how often do we impose ourselves to do that, to worship in the sight of the world as opposed to separating ourselves unto God and worshiping God all by ourselves? The world is going to tell you that's good for you. You're a Christian, that's good for you. Actually, I was talking to my brother-in-law yesterday, and he asked me if I'd seen a certain movie does your religion allow you to do that? And I went, I don't know, only if I sacrifice three chickens can I go to a movie. But, it was just because there was just a total lack of understanding about Christianity. But this is the same guy that, when I first became a Christian, said, that's good for you. I mean, if that works for you, that's great. Does that mean you're going to give up drinking? Well, I don't know. Maybe I can hold on to both of them. Okay, great. Everything's fine then. So, what they're asking you to do is to be balanced. Be balanced. Be a Christian. That's great. Especially if it works for you. But be balanced. Don't go too far. But I'm going to ask you, do we serve a balanced God? Is somebody who sends plague after plague after plague sound balanced to you? Is somebody who sends a son to a cross, do they sound balanced to you? Do we serve a balanced God? We do not. We serve a God who is all out. All out in love with us. All out in love with us. And we'll do what it takes to get our attention. Do we serve a balanced God? And should we serve God in a balanced way? Or should we, as as Moses says, no, we will not stay here, but we are going to go out to worship. We're going to separate ourselves. We're not going to stay in the world and worship under your control. We are leaving. Well, he says, besides, if we were to sacrifice in front of your people, the fact that we're sacrificing cows, which we're going to get into next, they might stone us. If we do what we're supposed to do as Christians, we're running that risk. We are definitely running that risk. But Moses says, no, I'd rather not be stoned at this point. Let's go out and we can sacrifice in private. So Pharaoh lies, says, okay, asks for prayer. Moses tells Pharaoh, no more lies. No more lies. So in chapter 8, verse 32, it says that his heart was hardened. But it says that Pharaoh hardened his heart. And what that means is, again, that he honored his own heart. He took his own counsel. He dulled his heart against anything that God had to say. Fifth plague was a disease on the beasts. The bull was called an apis, and it was the black bull, and it was the embodiment of Ptah, of the god of Memphis. And each bull was embalmed, and the soul, as when the bull died, that bull was embalmed, and it was thought that that soul of that bull, Ptah, went into the next bull, the next apis. Okay, that was the black bull. And as a matter of fact, it was the second largest temple in Memphis. The first one is Graceland, of course. Cows were also sacred. And the goddess, the god there was Hathor. And they were also sacred. Now, interestingly enough, the Egyptians once lost a battle because the enemy knew enough to put cows in front of them as they advanced. And so the Egyptians were so scared of shooting into the crowd, lest they kill a cow, that they were overrun. Wow. And we see the same thing today in Hinduism. It's the same idea. And that's where, honestly, we get the phrase sacred cow. And that we use that to describe something as immune to elimination. We can't touch that. We can't get rid of that. And we often set up our own sacred cows in our own relationship with God, being non-negotiable in our areas of sin and our areas of comfort. As I talked about before, when I first became a Christian, I was challenged, well, can you be a Christian and still drink? Well, sure. Sure can. To me, that was a sacred cow. That can't be eliminated. That's not something that I'm willing to give to God. Sixth plague, boils and sores. What this did was it shut down the worship of the priests in the temples. The boils made them, again, unfit because they were unclean. So it made them unfit to worship. So the temples were again shut down. And it was done without warning. Basically, God said, take a handful of ash, go right in front of Pharaoh, blow it into the air. And this was a direct hit against Imhotep, who was said to be the god of medicine. In chapter 9, verse 12, it says that the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he did not heed them, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. So in this case, God prevailed. God held Pharaoh's heart. Seventh plague, hail. Nut, the sky goddess. It was a warning. It was a warning. If you don't do this by tomorrow, it's going to rain down hail, fiery hail. And it says, I'm going to take all my plagues to your very heart. And I think that that was perhaps a warning of the death of the firstborn, because he said, buddy, this has been on Egypt so far. This has been against your gods. And pretty soon we're going to get very personal. Very personal. I'm going to take it straight to your heart if you don't relinquish control of my people. So, the reason why God says this to him, he says, so that you, Pharaoh, may know that I'm not just another Egyptian god. I'm not some capricious spirit. I am the Lord. I am the Lord. Do you remember that? What you said a while back? Who is the Lord that I may know you? Who is the Lord that I may obey you? That I have to obey you? I don't know you. Well, this is who you're dealing with. This is who you're dealing with. But what we cannot miss is that God is showing mercy to Pharaoh. He is showing mercy to Pharaoh. I warned you multiple times with specific warning. And it says here that I could have cut you off, destroyed you completely, but I haven't yet. I could have cut you off. I'm showing you mercy. And then he goes on to say in verse 16, for this purpose I have raised you up. Now anybody that is just really an honest student of the Bible has to look at that and say, what is that about? For this I raised you up? God, did you raise up Hitler? God, did you raise up those kids in Columbine? God, did you do that? Let me ask you something. Why wasn't Pharaoh killed when all the firstborn were killed? Why didn't he die when all the firstborn were killed? Because God didn't specify all the firstborn except Pharaoh. He said all of them that are not under the sign of the blood. Why? Pharaoh wasn't a firstborn. Pharaoh was not a firstborn. Either of the two pharaohs that we identified last week, the candidates of who could be Pharaoh, either one of those guys had an older brother that died before they could ascend to the throne. So Pharaoh was not the firstborn. God made sure that that was taken care of. So Pharaoh was raised up for that particular time. That was brought about by God. Pharaoh could have stopped there. He could have stopped there. And I honestly believe that we would be reading a very, very different version of Exodus if Pharaoh had said, okay, I give. Because I don't believe that God predestined the outcome. He simply spoke the truth. He sees the future, He knows the future, and He spoke the truth. But I don't think that He wrote out the script that Pharaoh had to follow. He simply said, this is the way it's going to play out. I believe that He used Pharaoh's hardness of heart so that it says in Scripture that even evil can glorify God. Remember the heart? Remember the clay? Didn't change the material. It simply hardened what was there. In verse 17 it says, you exalt yourself. It's the same idea as when it says that when Pharaoh hardened his heart, he says it kept his own counsel. You exalt yourself. When are you going to humble yourself before me? Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Proverbs 9:10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. Proverbs 13:33. The fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. The word there where it says that the kabod, where Pharaoh honored his heart, where God honored Pharaoh's heart, the kabod is the same word that's here. It says, the fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before kabod, before glory, before honor, is humility. Pharaoh, you are not giving me the glory that I deserve. And therefore, you're going to be punished. So is it fair that Pharaoh was raised up for this purpose? Is it fair? Can we really say that Pharaoh was an evil man if he was simply carrying out the will of God? Because the will of God was to show his power to the land of Egypt, and also to make sure that when Israel left Egypt, that the people would know what they encountered. 400 years later, the enemies of Israel still going, oh man, you were the guys that were in Egypt, and they're going, yeah, that's us. So if this was God's plan, can we accuse Pharaoh of being an evil man? Well, fairness assumes a standard of equity, and it assumes a standard of treatment. And in the United States, we have developed such a perverted sense of fairness where we blind ourselves to the difference. In the United States, opinions are created equal. Your opinion is as valid as mine. Opinions are simply facts and facts and consideration that you bring together and think about and come up with a conclusion. If your facts are wrong or incomplete, if the circumstances are not exactly as you understand them, then what's going to happen to the opinion? What's going to happen to the conclusion? But as ill-thought as somebody's opinion may be, it is the equal of somebody who is well-thought, knows all the facts, and so we all have an opinion. Now, we all have a right to an opinion. I'm not saying that. But we all become constitutional lawyers, and we say that I have a right to free speech. You are absolutely right. And as a good friend of mine says, my daddy always said, what's the use of being stupid if you can't show it occasionally? And that's exactly what we've come to. So this opinion is as good as this opinion. Lifestyles are protected as equal. So this lifestyle, whether it be against God's sins or not, is just as good as this lifestyle. Education is dumbed down so as not to offend. We all trying to reach that common area so nobody feels offended at all. Now, we are called to help those who do not have what we have. If we have, if it says that if we've received, then we need to give generously. And so we have a call as Christians to make sure that those who don't understand, that those who can't make it in our economy, those who have trouble reading, those that are slow or those that are diseased, that's exactly who we're supposed to be helping. But we can't help them if we don't recognize that there's a problem. So when we apply it to God, when we have that same sense of fairness and we apply that to God, we deny Him His sovereignty. We say that what you are doing is not fair. So the cry of unfair, you made me this way, now how can you judge me, starts with the supposition that God owes us something. Or that He must prove to us that He's sovereign in a way that we understand in our own terms. So while His nature is mercy, He still has the freedom to do exactly as He pleases. And in Romans 9, it says, what if God wanted to create one vessel for purposes of honor and one vessel for the purposes of dishonor? It doesn't say He does. It says, what if He did? Are you, as the clay, going to tell the potter what he's supposed to do? He does not choose to show His sovereignty. He chooses to show His grace and His mercy through His Son. But that does not rob Him or remove Him from His sovereignty. The very act of Him choosing Israel as a chosen people is an act of sovereign will. What's fair about that? What is fair about the fact that He chose a race of people and said, I'm going to pick you out of the world and you are going to be my bride? What's fair about that? It doesn't have to be fair. It has to be God. It has to be sovereign. We cannot know, and this is so important, we cannot know the extent of His mercy until we understand the depth of His power and glory. Let me repeat that. We cannot know the extent of His mercy until we understand the depth of His power and His glory. just like the magician said. This is the finger of God. It's not even the hand of God. It's the finger. And when we recognize His majesty and we recognize His glory, it would be like rummaging through your father's memorabilia and recognizing that he was a hero in the war. And you recognize what it is that he has done and what it is that he is capable of doing. And then you think back on how he's treated you with mercy and tenderness and kindness. And you go, wow. Wow. Those that feared the Lord in the land regarded the word of the Lord and were spared. They showed knowledge and they showed wisdom. They were given a warning. Guys, hail's coming tomorrow. If you move your cattle in, you'll be spared. If you stay off the streets, you'll be spared. But anybody that's caught outside is just, that's it. So there were people that were in the land that began to go, I think this God is real. And so they took heed and they bolted into their house and they made sure their cattle were out of the field and they were spared. Which means that something that we need to point out in a prior verse, it says that all the cattle were destroyed. The Hebrew, the actual Hebrew doesn't support all. Most of the cattle was destroyed, but the actual word in Hebrew does not support the fact that all cattle were destroyed with the diseases, because some were in fact destroyed through the hail. Now, in verse 27 and 28 of chapter 9, it says that Pharaoh sent and called for Moses and Aaron and said to them, I have sinned this time. The Lord is righteous, and my people and I are wicked. Entreat the Lord, there may be no more mighty thundering and hail, for it is enough. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. But Moses kept in mind, in verse 30, what God said about the firstborn. He's basically saying, it's not over, Pharaoh. You may say it's over. You're saying, oh, I'm sorry. But it's not over. It's not by a long shot over. Because he's remembering still the plague of the firstborn. So Pharaoh's heart, 934, Pharaoh honored his own heart. And he dulled his heart. In verse 935, then, it says, so the heart of Pharaoh was hard. And there it means God was holding it. God was prevailing over Pharaoh's heart, even still. Next one, locusts. That was against Osiris, the god of vegetation. Also, again, the god of the Nile. But it also showed that God controlled the wind. These locusts were said to be, when they were in repose, or at night when they were resting, if you will, they were said to have been 4 to 5 inches thick. That's how thick the locusts were. And of course, whenever you step on them, they stunk. And they ate every green thing in sight that wasn't destroyed by the hail. He says, whatever the remnant is from the hail is now gone with the locusts. And at this point, God looks to Pharaoh and says, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? And Pharaoh's council even feared this. We've had enough, Pharaoh. Basically looked at him and said, are you nuts? No, let me ask this a different way. Are you completely nuts? Let these people go. Let the men go, is what they said. And Pharaoh, I think, misunderstood and told Moses, okay, just the men can go. Just the men can go. So I have to ask myself, why, Pharaoh, are you trifling with God? Do you not understand? Then I have to ask myself, why do I trifle with God over those things in my own life where I know He's calling me to do something or He's calling me not to do something, and I bargain with Him and I trifle with Him and I'm trying to strike this great compromise with Him. So in verse 16 it says, please have your God remove the problem. Pray for me. Pray for me. Yet his heart is turned back when the problem is gone. There's sorrow because of the consequences, but there is still no repentance. There is still no humility before God. So Pharaoh's heart, chapter 10, verse 1, God honored or dulled his heart due to a lack of repentance and humility. And in verse 20, God prevailed. He held his heart. So actually, for the first time, it says this, it uses the same word that it had been using when it said Pharaoh hardened his heart. Now for the first time it says God hardened his heart, and the word that is being used is honored. He honored it. Okay, Pharaoh. We're past that point. We're done. So he honored what Pharaoh was going to do. The last plague that we're going to talk about today was darkness, which was against Ra, which was the most powerful of the gods. It was the sun god. Again, ninth plague, no warning. The light of God was completely removed. And it says that the darkness was so thick it can be felt. And the idea is that even if you were to light a candle, the light would be somehow absorbed. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Mammoth Cave. There's a certain cave in there. I don't remember which one it is. But you go in, and for a moment, they'll have everybody sit completely quiet, and they'll turn off the lights. There is no natural light in there. Zero light in there. And so for a moment, which becomes a panicky moment after a while, you're in total darkness. Complete and total darkness. And what they're saying here is that the dark was so thick it could be felt. And I think what possibly happened is that the Lord simply removed his spirit. God was not there. And so the darkness was utter and the darkness was total. However, in Goshen, they're partying until midnight. They got plenty of light. So for 3 days, it says, no one moved or saw each other. For 3 days, no Egyptian moved or saw each other because the darkness was so thick. So, Pharaoh, one more attempt at compromise. One more attempt. He still does not recognize that God is God of all. And he says, all right, this is the deal. You go, take all your kids, take all your family, leave the livestock. Fair enough? Well, I said, no. Two things. Number one, we need the livestock because we really don't know what kind of sacrifice God's asking for, and so we need to take them along with us. Number two, we're not going to leave a hoof behind. It's all God's. And you're not in a position to compromise whether you think or not. Well, that got Pharaoh so inflamed that he says, go. I don't ever want to see your face again. If I see your face again, I will kill you. And Moses said, you're right. You will never see my face again. The next plague would be the Passover. It would be the death of the firstborn. So often. So often. When God says, I want all of it, we offer part of it. Whether it's our lives, whether it's our hearts, whether it's our families, whether it's our fortunes, everything that we have is God's, and he says, I want all of it. And we all say, okay, Lord, you can have some of it. And he says, not one hoof will I leave behind. If you don't give me all of it, I will take away all of it. Why does he do that? Why does he do that? Because he wants our hearts so bad, because he loves us so much, that he wants nothing, absolutely nothing in the way between us and eternity. And he wants nothing in the way between us and a loving relationship with him while we're on earth. Nothing. So he's willing to take away that which will rust, that which will rot, that which will burn, so that we may not be denied that fellowship with God. He's willing to do that. Pharaoh's heart, verse 10:27, God held Pharaoh's heart in